From Feature Story News in Washington, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special edition of our program, an extended interview with the feminist, author and journalist Germaine Greer. In her new book, White Beach, she tells of her experiences rehabilitating 150 acres of Australian rainforest and what it taught her about the environment.
There was a good deal of thinking from the very beginning about How have men treated this planet? Well, they've done their best to classify it and get it to stay in its right place, in the right drawer with the right label. And they've also done their best to exploit it. And the results are getting to be fairly terrifying.
That's Germaine Greer talking about the lessons she learned in the rainforest on this special edition of FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Israeli government and Palestinian militants have agreed to a long-term ceasefire in Gaza. The truce ends 7 weeks of violent conflict that brought about over 2,200 casualties. Militant group Hamas claims the deal, which was brokered by Egypt, is a victory for the resistance and shows Hamas has won the fight. But in reality, the terms of the deal are a return to the previous ceasefire from 2012. The United States gave its support for a long-term ceasefire, as expressed here by State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki.
We view this as an opportunity, not a certainty. Today's agreement comes after many hours and days of negotiations and discussions, but certainly there's a long road ahead.
The U.S. has started surveillance flights over Syria. President Barack Obama has authorized the missions in order to gain intelligence on the activities of Islamic State militants. It could pave the way for U.S. airstrikes inside Syria, where the jihadist group controls vast stretches of territory. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
The White House says Obama has not approved any military action inside Syria. But Pentagon officials have been drafting a range of options for him, including airstrikes. The surveillance flights include unmanned drones as well as manned aircraft to gather intelligence that would likely be needed before the president could take any further action. Obama has resisted military action in Syria, but Pentagon officials are said to have advised him that the only way the threat from IS can be fully eliminated is to go after the group there. The US is already carrying out strikes against IS in neighboring Iraq. Kate Fisher, Washington.
French President François Hollande has named a new government following the cabinet's resignation over a bitter row over economic policy. Mr. Hollande has let go ministers who rebelled against his direction of tight fiscal restrictions. Europe correspondent Jack Perrock has more.
It wasn't the return from the summer holidays French President François Hollande was hoping for, as three of his ministers rebelled against his decision to continue to follow what's perceived as German-imposed austerity measures. The French economy has seen two consecutive quarters of no growth, and the president's popularity in France is down at 17%.
As schools start up again in the United States, official figures show that this will be the first year where white students will be in the minority. This is due to the country's changing demographics, particularly due to a rise in Hispanic school children in the U.S. So, for the first time, the percentage of white students in the country's body has fallen below 50%, with 26% of students Hispanic and 15% African American. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Pedro Poroshenko are meeting in Minsk to discuss the ongoing crisis in eastern Ukraine. The talks in the Belarusian capital come amid growing tension between the two countries over Kiev's military operation against pro-Russian rebels. Our correspondent Tom Barton is in Minsk, and he says that official Russian statements this week are likely to have further angered Kiev.
Here in Minsk, the planned talks between Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin may have had some spanners thrown into the works after comments by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Among them, that there was another convoy that was being planned to be sent across the Russia-Ukraine border. They were going to try and get agreement for that with the Ukrainians, but without agreement, judging by the past convoy, which was sent across anyway, much to international outrage, the potential lies for that to happen again.
And an earthquake aftershock measuring 3.9 on the Richter scale has rattled the Northern California area, hit by a 6.0 earthquake over the weekend. The earthquake came at a critical time for Napa County's multi-billion dollar wine industry in the midst of its harvest. And as cleanup crews continue their efforts, damage estimates are climbing. Rachel Silverman reports from Napa.
The U.S. Geological Survey estimates the 6.0 magnitude earthquake caused as much as $1 billion in damage. According to Kinetic Analysis Corporation, which estimates damages from natural disasters, the quake's total impact is likely to reach $4 billion. That includes property damage, losses from business disruptions, and lost tax revenue. 200 people were injured in the quake, three of them critically. Dozens of buildings have been tagged as unfit to enter, and hundreds of customers are still waiting for their water service to be reconnected.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We devote our entire program today to an interview with the feminist and author Germaine Greer. She is, she says, many things, but not an icon.
How does it feel to be an icon? Be called an icon? I'm not an icon. I'm a person. And to make an icon of me is to reduce me. But also, icons are holy. I'm unholy.
It has been 44 years since Germaine Greer's seminal work, The Female Eunuch, became an international bestseller and touched off a firestorm of debate about feminism. Its main thesis, that the suburban, consumer-oriented nuclear family represses women sexually and leaves them in a passive role. In her 1971 review of the book, Sally Kempton wrote in the New York Times that I would like to believe, as she does, that love between men and women is possible, even in the course of a feminist revolution. The revolutionary discussions of the time were televised, including one famous interaction at New York City's Town Hall between Germaine Greer and Norman Mailer.
Every single feminist knows that the analysis that we have to make of society is very intricate and will take a long time. If it took Mao Zedong so long to actually define the particular causes and problems involved in what was a blank slate situation, we had the most overwritten slate, the most over-indoctrinated and coward population to try to turn on. And we have so many intricate problems involved in each level of our society that it's quite absurd to demand of any woman at this stage that she show you the complete analysis or that she stand convicted of having made it.
I'm all for that. I'm all for that. But I would ask you, why then do you women keep saying, without having made the analysis, why do you keep being so certain that it's entirely the male fault?
I didn't know that any women were certain that it was entirely the male fault. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's precisely what we're trying to elicit. And if the fact is that men have been unconsciously tyrannical, and I think it probably is the case, then it's certain also that they were debauched by their own tyranny and degraded by it and confused by it almost as much as the people they tyrannized over.
Today, Germaine Greer has a new book looking at, for her, a new subject, environmentalism, and specifically her experience trying to rehabilitate 150 acres of Australian rainforest. The book is called White Beach, The Rainforest Years, and she talked about it with Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio. He started by asking her why she'd decided to acquire a section of Australian rainforest in the first place.
It's a very good question. And the short answer is the rainforest itself. Also, I wanted people to understand something about taking a small piece of land, 150 acres, and doing what you could to restore it was balm for the ache you feel all the time when you see the terrible mess we're making of everything. You know, that we've cleared the lower slopes of the Himalaya with the result that Pakistan is being pushed into the sea. And nobody ever mentions that. They're all prattling on about climate change. But that's a real and present danger. We've seen them flooded in consecutive years, and there's been very high loss of life. But even more, there's been degradation of their environment. So soon, the Indo-Gangetic Plain will not support that population. And if you're thinking about things like that, and you feel that twist that says, this shouldn't be happening, everything's going to hell in a handbasket, how do we make anybody care? And then you realise in the end that you can't make anybody care. There are people running around with placards and people demonstrating and so on, but they have no clout. You want them to have clout. So then I have to think of another way, and I think, right, I've had a fantastic time with this forest. The forest has taught me what I needed to know, and the forest has put all the energy into the process. Now I want other people to understand that this is an option. You can do this. And if we start a fashion, fashion's a huge thing. If it becomes the cool thing to do, to when you buy a property, say, to uproot all the ridiculous things that people have put in it, their coccus palms or their fake this, that and the other.
Decking.
Oh, decking. Rat housing, yes. Get it all out of there and then try to understand what was there before. Because when you get the right suite of plants, it always makes sense. It is always beautiful.
The fascinating thing about this book is that when people see Germaine Greer on the front of a book, they're not going to expect a book about a subject like this. And when someone said to me, oh, we've got Germaine Greer in, coming in to do an interview, and I said, well, what's she written now? And they said, oh, a book about a rainforest. I kind of inwardly sighed. But having read, I'm about a quarter way through it, having read it, it's absolutely fascinating. What you're doing, I think, is appealing to a whole new group of people who just wouldn't expect to read you writing about this sort of thing.
Well, there is an intellectual connection, though, because one of the earliest offshoots of the of second-wave feminism was ecofeminism. And it, in some ways, it was a reaction to the idea of the selfish gene, because that was such a masculine idea. You know, I'm just tromping around the earth and I'm trying to pass on my genes and colonise the earth and unbalance everything. And whereas, in fact, that was only one side of the story. Then women scientists began having a look, and they discovered that actually there are organisms that are altruistic, that work as a group, even organisms that sacrifice themselves for the life of the group. Altruism is the other side of the coin of the selfish gene. And a gene that isn't altruistic enough will be overcome by a gene that works as part of a collectivity. So there was a good deal of thinking from the very beginning about how have men treated this planet? Well, they've done their best to classify it and get it to stay in its right place, in the right drawer with the right label. And they've also done their best to exploit it. And the results are getting to be fairly terrifying. We're losing biodiversity, which is our true riches. Forget the Houses of the Great and the National Trust and all of that. Even art museums and even libraries, the baseline is biodiversity, the extraordinary riches and extravagance of this planet. It's so full of creativity and crazy stuff. So then you find women beginning to, sometimes they turn it into a fake religion, it becomes Gaia and blah, blah, blah. I've never found that necessary. As an earthling, I understand that I need all the other earthlings. I'm related to them. I share their DNA. I can't go out and live on a tea tray in outer space because they have to come with me. If they don't come with me, I can't grow a carrot. I'm going to, what will I live on? I'll live on chemical inputs of one sort or another. How hideous is that? What will I have to look at? Extrastellar darkness is what I'll have to look at. We need this earth and we need to protect it. We will not survive it if we destroy it.
How did you come across this particular piece of land in Australia?
Well, first of all, I looked. I looked and looked and looked. I looked in southern New South Wales. I looked in the Northern Territory.
Which, if you talk about biodiversity, I mean, I've been to the Northern Territory once, and it's just absolutely fascinating, sort of everywhere you go. And there's not a person to be seen for miles and miles and miles, which you just don't get in this country.
Where did you go?
It was a place called was it Castle Point? It was 300 miles from Darwin, and it was apparently there was no settlement within 100 miles of this place. And it was sort of rich in sort of crocodiles and...
So you were on the coast?
Yeah, on the coast. And it was just the most amazing place. You could imagine sort of... I mean, there was a sort of... Where some of the first settlers came to Australia, they apparently landed quite near there. And it was just something unlike anywhere I had ever been, anywhere in the world, just so remote.
That's tropical. So a lot of the plants that you would have seen there... you would have in common with many of the offshore islands and some parts of the subcontinent of India, whereas the forest that I'm involved with is subtropical Gondwanan rainforest. And that's partly it's partly by accident. I mean, I decided I didn't want to invest in a part of the Northern Territory and that I couldn't fix the southern highlands of New South Wales because there were just too many weeds. And I couldn't really see a way forward at all. And then I went and did a charity do for a women's aid organisation in Logan, south of Brisbane, where a lot of migrant families ended up, where the women under tremendous stress lost their female support structure at their husband's mercy, frightened, lonely, inarticulate, couldn't speak the language. And they were setting up what they thought were the sort of baseline services that these women needed. And they asked me if I'd give a talk, and I said, yeah. And they said, how much would it cost? I said, just hire the hall, and what you get, put in your pocket. So we did that, and it was a great night. It was great fun. They gave me a painting that I frankly hated. I've still got to try and get rid of.
They're all listening as we speak.
Yes, yes. Well, don't give me a painting. if you want. Anyway, so I... Then I said to them after that, you know, I've been looking for a piece of land. I've looked all over the place and I can't find anything. Nothing wants to give itself to me. And they said, oh, well, there was always Ken's mother's place. So Ken and his wife, Jane Francis, came and got me the next morning because they were desperate to sell this place. And they took me there and I thought, oh, God, it's rundown dairy farm. Also known
gullible Jermaine, we can flog it to her.
No, I don't think they did think that, actually. They just, their mother was a doctor in the public service, and so was her son. He was volunteering as a psychiatrist. He's now a member of the Royal College here. He was volunteering for the charity. And they just wanted to get the cash back out of it so that their mother had something to live on. Because you don't get a very huge pension if you've been badly paid all your life. And they just wanted to do the best they could and to get it over with. They'd put a pretty big effort into selling it. They'd had it surveyed for tourist development, but there'd not been a single offer. And then they wanted $1 million for it. By the time I came along, they only wanted $500,000 for it. And in those days, $500,000 was less than the cost of a one-bedroom flat in London. Well, much less now, I think. And so I thought, well, I can just about afford it. But do I want it? Because it was so run down and so beaten up. And I was rehearsing how to say thank you for taking me to see it, which took them all day. But I don't think I'm going to buy it. And then for some reason I thought, I'm not going to fly to Sydney and go home to England. I'm going to drive. And I'm going to stop again at the farm, which was on the way. I booked myself into a ridiculous resort. So I had somewhere to sleep. And I went back at dusk. And a bird appeared. Came out from the raspberries. There's wild raspberries up there. And he danced. He was just...
A sign.
Moving his bottom in and out.
A twerking Australian bird.
He was so sweet and so funny. And every time I looked away from him, he came round to get in my eye line. No, no, watch. And it was getting dark, and I realised I was going to be stuck out in the middle of the Mulga with no notion of where the gate was. So I had to say to him, Bertie, I have to go. But he sold it to me. It was gone. And as I walked out, I saw the guy who was living in the house leaning on the veranda rail. And I thought, I said, hi. And I thought, I'm going to buy your house. You're going to be roofless.
Well, after hearing about her experience of finding and securing the land, I then asked her how long it took to rehabilitate it.
Well, it's not rehabilitated yet. We're about halfway there, I'd say. The first thing you do is you find a botanist. And we found a botanist with local knowledge who made our first plant survey. And he did say to me, you realise you've got some of the highest biodiversity outside the wet tropics. This is an extraordinary jewel. And in fact, one of the brilliant young botanists who works with me now has just done his postgraduate degree and mapping the biodiversity of all the Gondwana rainforests in Australia, which go from the border ranges of Queensland down to the Barrington Tops, which is about a little bit north of Newcastle. And they're just strings. They're just little isolated beads on a string. And I think altogether they probably come to something like 80,000 square kilometres, which sounds like a lot but really isn't when it's all divided up into these little bits. So I didn't realise that. I had no idea what I bought. I bought what the bird sold me. Then I had to find out and I had to examine it. So that was a bit of a surprise. But now we've got probably three times as many species because we've had better botanists doing the surveying for us, and we've also surveyed all the other things, the gymnosperms, all the ferns and the mosses and the orchids and the epiphytes and the vines, and it turns out to be stupendous. The other thing, the thing I knew by looking at this forest was that you could restore it. You had a chance. You had enough of the original material around, battered and dispersed as it was, and you had 2 metres of rain a year, which can't be bad. We had high fertility basalt soil. We had everything we needed. It still wasn't a walk in the park. Mm-hmm. We still got things wrong, and we had to regroup and think hard about how we were doing things. We were given wrong advice by practically everybody. Now I think we've got it right, but that's because we've tried it and tested it.
It would have made a great TV programme if you had a camera with you going through the whole story, wouldn't it? I mean, it sounds absolutely fascinating.
Well, I did. I had my little video cameras, but I've used them as notebooks to remind myself, because I'm there 2 months in the spring and 2 months in the autumn, and the point of the notebooks is to remind me what I was asking myself then. You know, why is this little tree struggling? What is the insect that's infesting this tree? Is this tree being shaded out? All that sort of thing. What is that bird I can hear? And I would have told you that I still didn't know most of the birds. Mm. And it always comes as a big surprise. You suddenly realise, I do know all those voices. I've learnt them over the years. Likewise, the trees. My sister, who's a botanist, would wail and say, I can't do these trees. What is that again? Because she works on the Mornington Peninsula in the south. And I was like that too. I thought, oh, I'll never learn them. I have to be told again and again. And now I know them. And I don't, it's just familiarity and just concentrating and trying hard to remember them.
You've got real passion for it, and that comes through, I think, in the writing. It was an absolutely beautifully written book, as I guess we would expect from you. But how difficult was it writing sort of some of the more scientific things that you talk about, sort of all the creatures, the different aspects of biodiversity?
The only thing that worried me about them was that I might bore people. So you start off saying, you know, whenever we do anything in the forest, we're haunted by a whole mob of dead German chemists whose names have got stuck all over our plants, which is mad. And then I have to try and explain why, like many botanists, I'm absolutely in love with Robert Brown, more or less self-trained, Scots, army doctor, who began working with a man working on ferns in the Highlands and wrote most of his book and didn't get credited for it, then goes out to Australia, paid for by Joseph Banks, and stays for, I forget now how long, 2 years, and just accumulates this huge list of species, all of which he calls by their own names, which I love. If it's got a sharp leaf, he calls it the sharp leaf something. He doesn't call it O'Brien's whatever. He is a funny man because he came home with a native man. And Joseph Banks had to tell him to send him straight back home again. So I'm not quite sure what happened there.
Best not to speculate, I think. How is Australia different now to the Australia you left, what was it, 1970, around then?
Well, it's in worse shape.
Really?
Oh, yes. Well, from my point of view, definitely. There are more huge holes being dug to take out various minerals. We've just had an important leak in Jabiru, which is the uranium mine next to Kakadu, where radioactive water has escaped into the groundwater. Stupid. Absolutely predictable. It's always been a ramshackle affair where the public was never allowed to go. The only time I tried to see it, I got frog marched out of there. Then I tried to persuade the pilot of the plane taking me out of there to fly over the mine. He told me I can't do that. I said, why can't you do that? He said, because they'll fire at me. Can you believe it? That's my country. It was bad enough then and it's worse now. Now we're taking coal out of the coal fields of Queensland as fast as we possibly can, shipping it to China. This is not particularly good for the ecosphere generally, but also these huge container ships are crossing the Barrier Reef, and the Barrier Reef is a World Heritage Site, and a Japanese coal container ship went aground on the reef for 9 days, and it tore a trench in the reef that is 3 kilometres long and I think 26 metres wide. This is truly, truly shocking, and you wonder, would the UN do anything? Will the UN say to Australia, excuse me, it's a World Heritage Site? That means you're a custodian. You don't own it. You can't trash it. You have to take care of it. But they've never exerted their authority, and the Australians will just blow them off.
Do you think it's a country that still has a massive problem with sort of almost institutional racism? But I mean, obviously, we know about the Aboriginal problem. But Trenton Oldfield, the guy that was disrupted the boat race the other year, he also says it's a fundamentally racist country. Is that your experience?
I'm not sure that I ever found a country that wasn't fundamentally racist. Most countries have elites. Most countries have a notion of what they look like and don't like people who don't look like that. It's easy to beat up on strangers, especially if you feel guilty yourself. I don't think Australia is especially racist. The Aboriginal situation is being appallingly badly handled, possibly deliberately. Now the Aborigines' greatest ally is supposed to be the mining companies that have been able to persuade people that they will give Aboriginal people, the traditional owners, a fair deal. They won't. They don't give anyone a fair deal, except maybe their stockholders, and I'm not even sure about that. They claim that there will be trickle-down effects from the exploitation of mineral wealth. There aren't any such trickle-down effects. I've been through the coalfields of Queensland, and they haven't resulted in the building of a shop, one shop, or a pub even, imagine. It's fly in, fly out. The guys can fly in. They work double shift if they can. They sleep in dongas. They get flown back home for 3 weeks. That's where they spend their money. There's no point in... You certainly won't build a church, will you, or a dance hall or anything. There's nothing.
That's Germaine Greer. Her new book is called White Beach, The Rainforest Years. It's published by Bloomsbury in the USA, and the hardback edition is coming out on July 15th. Germaine Greer was talking to Ian Dale, host of the evening Drive Time programme on Britain's LBC Radio. And that's our special edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com, and you can interact with us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. From Washington, goodbye.